from PowerlineBlog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierenkopf, and Stephen Hayward.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to another episodic and nearly random edition of the Powerline Show. It's Steve Hayward here today, just with Scott Johnson, in something of a special edition. Sooner or later, we're going to revive the dormant Powerline Show, maybe experiment with some new formats. But getting the four of us together is like getting the four Beatles back together. Not that we've broken up. It's just getting the four of us together in one place at one time for an hour. These days is nearly impossible. So in any event, Scott and I are together here today for a very special purpose. New film about Winston Churchill called Darkest Hour opens to general release this week. It's been out selectively for 3 or 4 weeks now. And there's quite a split among conservative movie reviewers over it. Kyle Smith at National Review really hated it. Roger Simon down at Pajamas Media didn't write a review, but wrote me a short email saying that he hated it and turned off his screener because as a member of the Motion Picture Academy, he got a screener, which made me very jealous. A few conservative reviewers like John Podhoretz like the movie, but I've heard others like Sonny Bunch and Jonathan Last at their, as I like to say, appropriately named substandard podcast, both trashed the movie. They really hated it too. And so we have a split here at Powerline. Scott didn't like it. And I didn't like it at first either. I was practically yelling at the screen, at the screening I saw a week ago. But then I changed my mind for some surprising and odd and maybe indefensible reasons. We'll see. But Scott, I think you've now seen it twice, I think. Did you change your mind at all in a second viewing? And before, by the way, I shut up and let you talk. I should say that I have a telegram for you. Not a telegram, but an email, really, from Larry Arn at Hillsdale. Who says, tell Scott to straighten up. So anyway, Scott, why don't you summarize what your considered judgment is now on two viewings of Darkest Hour?
Did you have to say just with Scott Johnson?
What did I just say?
I'm kidding. When you introduced me, Steve, it sounded dumb.
Oh, like, well, I meant that the other two guys aren't with us.
Like it was Ringo. Steve, I wanted to say I have seen the film twice, most recently yesterday, and I have also read the screenplay. The first time I saw it, I found it very hard to understand the dialogue. And so I read the screenplay and was able to understand it the second time around. It seems to me somewhat challenging, a very smart screenplay. But I really hated the film. And the last 45 minutes, I found it hard to sit through. Knowing what I do about Churchill and thinking about how the movie got him wrong. And I, you know, would willing to be corrected by you and by Larry, but these are my thoughts. I thought, and I hope seeing it a second time, maybe I can deepen my critique for the purposes of contrast. But I thought yesterday as I was watching it, I thought of the Churchill motto that I think goes with one of his books, Facts Are Better Than Dreams, one of his World War books. And this movie, it seemed to me, gave us the screenplay writer Anthony McCartan's dream of Churchill as an ordinary man, if a gifted orator. And but that the theme of the film is that the great Churchill, as I think you and I know him, never was. Your teacher Harry Jaffa asked, "Will there ever be another Churchill?" It seemed to me that the theme of the film, is that there never was a Winston Churchill. It seemed to me that the movie was an exercise in reduction. And early on, Winston's wife, Clementine, the Clementine of history, says to the fictional secretary who's having a difficult first day on the job regarding Winston, he's a man like any other. And I think that is genuinely one of the themes of the film. My original reaction to the film was that it's stupid and false, and I stand by my original reaction. It seems to me that the film's most outrageous inventions are in the service of its stupidity. And I take as my proof text on this point the comments of McCartan made a couple of months ago. And I think he's obviously an extraordinarily talented screenwriter, but I thought that this was an important, it gave me, I would say, some confirmation of the way I looked at the movie. while acknowledging that, that Churchill was a great orator and acknowledging his familiarity with Churchill's great speeches, McCartan says, and forgive me while I read a paragraph. This is McCartan.
Sure. Yeah, please do.
The received picture of Winston Churchill is this pugnacious warrior who never brooked any doubt and was just fight them, fight them, fight them. But when you actually dive into the minutes of the war records, you find a man who shifted his position often by the hour on this issue. And that's what's lacking in our normal historical version of this guy, because this is not something that's ever been celebrated, that he had doubts, that he was uncertain. And that's Churchill, according to McCartan, in this movie, it seems to me. And there's a reason we haven't seen it celebrated before. Steve, I ask you, you as the author of Greatness, why haven't we seen that celebrated before?
In which part? You mean the part that he was actually an ordinary man?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because it's wrong.
That's my point. Okay.
Yeah. No, your criticism of McCartan is a good one. And I do think he is. I understand he's coming out with his own book on this period, although I don't know why, because I think John Lukacs has written the definitive book on this. And there are other books. I don't see how he can produce anything that isn't tendentious. But first of all, I'm not sure if you're finished. Well, actually, we're going to go through an inventory here, I think, in a minute of some of aspects of it.
I just have a couple other points.
Sure, sure, go ahead.
Just to elaborate on that, that was really just my introduction, but just to elaborate with the film's scenes a little bit, it seems to me that the film takes us through it obviously takes us through the dramatic meetings of the War Cabinet in May 1940, when Churchill had to fight off Halifax and occasionally Chamberlain, arguing that England should seek to negotiate terms with Hitler, while not offending them so much as that they would leave this war cabinet of five ministers, including Churchill, who had appointed himself Minister of Defense as well as Prime Minister, as well as having become Prime Minister by invitation of the King. He needed to keep them close. He needed them to keep them in the cabinet so that his government wouldn't fall. And to do that, it seems to me required both extraordinary, to do that while fighting off their argument that England was in such a position that it had no reasonable alternative but to seek to negotiate terms, that it required both extraordinary strength and tact under unbelievable stress. And when I came home and started rereading the history, including John Lukacs, the five days in London, and Martin Gilbert's his volume Finest Hour in the authorized biography, just to read what Churchill was doing on any given one of those given days in May is exhausting all by itself. Just under unbelievable stress, the decisions he had to make, the things he had to do. In the film, however, and Churchill withstood all that, maintained his judgment, maintained his eloquence, won the arguments in the cabinet, kept Halifax and Churchill on board. In the film, however, Churchill is beaten down until on May 27th, he authorizes Halifax to explore negotiations with Hitler through the Italian ambassador. And the film, in the climax of that sequence of events, it portrays Churchill virtually catatonic, sitting, is it on the side of a couch in the dark by himself in a robe. And Clemmy enters and turns on the lights, finds him by himself, just shockingly distraught, reduced to nullity. And just before that, Churchill is bucked up a little bit by his fictional secretary, Elizabeth Leighton.
Right.
Then Clemmy bucks him up at that moment, reminding him of his wisdom, which is his doubts, picking up the theme that McCartan intimates in that interview. And then that's all an introduction to receiving King George VI to talk to Churchill. Apparently as a result of a brief lunch that they've had earlier that day or the day before, King George VI has revised his view of Churchill and come to understand him, and that Churchill has somehow won him round and persuaded him to such a point where it's now King George VI who bucks up Churchill in his moment of great need. And it seems to me the darkest hour that's referred to in the title of the film is really that moment that's depicted of Churchill, where he hits bottom and is picked up by King George VI. And those scenes of bucking up climax in the most stupid scene of all, the one in the underground that you wrote about on Powerline, that I just found almost unbearable in its stupidity. And he, on that ride, Churchill gets pep talks from different varieties of the British common man. And they give Churchill his strength and even seem to give him the material for his great speech to the outer cabinet on the afternoon of May 28th. It's on his way to that meeting that he takes the underground. And in that meeting with the outer cabinet in which he makes, you know, the most famous remarks as we now know them, about whether he needs to parley with that man, and if he were to choose to do so, how they would all rise up against him and so on. He cites these people he's met on the underground by name, attributing the thought to them. And it seems to me that was like painting a mustache on the Mona Lisa. I really found it revolting in its wrongness. And so I credit the screenplay with a kind of brilliant perversity. As a work of art, it seems to me the theme of the film is that the Churchill of history as we know him never existed. I don't think that's great, and I don't think it's true. And with that, I would invite you to make the contrary case.
Well, I'm tempted to leave that old joke about other than that, because Lincoln, how did you like the play? Well, so first of all, I guess what I think is all those criticisms are very good, and I have my own complaints with several of those scenes, especially the one with the king you mentioned, and I'll come back to that presently. Oddly enough, though, I actually thought the last 45 minutes or so of the film are what fixed it and what saved it from going completely wrong. I sort of worked through some of these things. First of all, and you can quarrel with this approach to it. One is that if you're trying to evaluate or demand that a film be, first of all, is a film history or is it art? Now, it can be both. It doesn't have to be wholly one or the other. But certainly as a history, you'd be quite right that it's completely bollocked up. Although it wouldn't be the first Churchill film to do such a thing. But as art, as someone who's, say, not an expert in Churchill, someone who doesn't know the story, I think what you might come away with that is a different impression. I actually think that the Churchill himself is too big, and also Oldham. We could talk a little bit about his performance. Both Oldham in his performance and the story itself is too big to overrides McCartan's flawed premise. And I'll sort of work backwards from this. I mean, I thought the very last scene of the movie where Churchill was walking out of the House of Commons after giving the Dunkirk speech to the rousing cheers. And by the way, they place it on the wrong day. That's another liberty they took with the facts of the matter. But be that as it may, that last scene where Oldham is walking out of, as Churchill is walking out of the House of Commons, you can see a difference in his step and in his bearing. And, you know, if you take it that the whole point of the movie culminates in that scene, and Churchill has found his voice, he's found his direction, and he's solidified his position. Because, you know, part of the story is accurate. Churchill's position was extremely weak those early weeks of the war. And a lot of his party didn't want him, probably a majority. And, you know, if Halifax had gone through with his threatened resignation, which is what he did do, they didn't really dramatize it. Well, I don't remember now how well they dramatized it in the movie. But if he had resigned on May 27th or 28th, it might well have brought down Churchill's government and ended it right away. So, you know, what I think is, and also there's some reason to think that, although I think the dramatization of it was could have been better, I think there's some reason to think that Churchill did have grave doubts and in some respects was improvising from moment to moment. And then the whole problem with negotiating with Hitler is poorly done in the film, because partly this was a three-way problem. It wasn't just the direct negotiations in prospect between Britain and Germany. But you had France that kept saying, we think we need to seek terms, which, of course, they eventually did. And, you know, why, you know, why shouldn't we do the same thing, or should we go along with France? And Gilbert's account of this is really quite rich, saying, if we knew what terms might be available, we would entertain them. It was very passive in a certain way, because I wanted to preserve some latitude. But we're not going to open negotiation with them, and we're not going to ask the Italians to do it for us. So the situation was kind of fluid. I mean, there's a few comments about it. I think that an awful lot of people are going to come away from the movie saying, gosh, I didn't know about that clash with Halifax. I didn't know that everything was in the balance in the first 3 weeks. And partly because, and now I'm rambling here a bit, that whole story itself was not learned until much later in the sort of grand scheme of things. I think it was not discovered until Martin Gilbert published his Finest Hour volume in the early 1980s, because the cabinet minutes had been closed under the old Official Secrets Act of Britain, and no one had bothered to scour some of the diaries that Gilbert found that had some accounts of that speech, which Churchill mistold in his own memoirs. See, so, you know, Churchill himself is the author of some of the older impression we have that from the moment he took office in May 10th, there was just one direction and he had solid support behind him. And when, in fact, you know, we learned later it was a much closer run thing than that. So anyway, that's a few opening thoughts. I'll say one more thing about that scene with the king. And here's where something that annoys me about a lot of Churchill films, and especially this one, is in the middle of that, Churchill says to the king, "Nations which go down fighting rise again, but those which surrender tamely are finished," which is a pretty good and strong statement. He didn't say that to the king. He right. said that directly to Halifax in one of those war cabinet meetings. Right. And McCartan went and moved it to this conversation with the king. And so, you know, that's a liberty that I think he shouldn't have taken and didn't need to. I think that would have worked better in one of the dramatizations of the war cabinet meeting. I actually think the film should have been a half an hour longer, and you could have gotten to you could have done some of these things a little better and more faithfully and still just as dramatically. Anyway, as I say, I think as art, it's a more successful film. As history, it's problematic. But maybe what we ought to do is I think maybe it'd be worth it for our listeners, those who've seen it and those who haven't seen it but want to, maybe we ought to go through some of the historical inaccuracies in it. These aren't really spoilers, right? We can alternate on this, but I'll start with the very opening scene, which is, you know, the first time I wanted to yell at the screen. The very opening scene of the movie is the debate in the House on May 9th, and you have Clement Attlee, the leader of the Labor Party, yelling at Chamberlain, saying, "You have to go. It's incompetent government. We'll serve in a national government, but we'll never serve under you." Then the camera slowly cuts away to an empty seat on the front bench where Churchill's supposed to be. And someone whispers, I forget, it's in the script. I remember the names, but not right now. I don't remember the names. Anyway, one says to the other, I think it's Eden, supposed to be Anthony Eden, saying, "Where's Winston?" And the other fellow says, "Ah, he wants to make sure his fingerprints aren't on the murder weapon." Well, guess what? That is completely wrong. In the debate in the House on May 9th, guess who gave the summary speech in defense of Chamberlain? It was none other than Churchill. See, so I mean, that they've completely turned upside down and distorted what actually took place there. Now, one problem there is that the full story would be very hard to tell in a movie that wasn't, say, an 8-hour miniseries like we did with The Wilderness Years 30 years ago. In fact, it was the real blow to Chamberlain came from his own party from the day before by Leo Amery, who culminated in leading a bunch of defectors against Chamberlain. By reciting the famous lines, I guess from Cromwell, the Long Parliament, "You have sat here too long for any good you have done. In the name of God, go." That was really the speech that broke Chamberlain. The problem was, is to tell a storyline about the Conservative Party being against Churchill, it would have been very confusing to try and dramatize that in 2, 3, 4 minutes on film. So I think I understand why.
Against Chamberlain?
What's that?
Did you mean the Conservative Party against Chamberlain?
Against Churchill is what I meant to say, for Chamberlain. Yeah, I misspoke, thanks.
Not following.
Right. Yeah, and so it would have been hard to tell, and so they simplified it, although I do think, you know, having that gratuitous line about Churchill not wanting his fingerprints on a murder weapon really is, and so viewers should know that scene is completely wrong.
Well, it seems to me that the film erases Churchill's magnanimity in a number of respects. that are important to understanding what actually happened that month. The one that you point out is a great example. One other one I would point out is all the scenes set in 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's residence, as of May 10th, when Churchill became Prime Minister. They show him moving into 10 Downing Street right away and celebrating with his family in the living room there, his ascension to this office, which he sought since he was in the crib. And in truth, Churchill invited Chamberlain to remain in 10 Downing Street until he could move out at his convenience. And Churchill remained in the Admiralty House. I think it was a token of Churchill's diplomacy with Chamberlain, just as his defense of Chamberlain on the floor of Parliament on May 9th was. When Churchill ascended to the office and needed to keep Chamberlain at that point on board for support for his government, he treated him with all the respect that he could muster. And the falsity of showing Churchill in 10 Downing Street, it seems to me, is one of the instances of the movie disabling our understanding of Churchill's tact in that month and his success with the personalities whom he had to deal with. I think another good example, Steve, that you raised before we started talking is the meeting in Paris with the French. Is it with Reynaud? Is he the president?
President or prime minister? I forget.
Yeah, prime minister, I guess. On May 16th in Paris. Yeah. There are two meetings in Paris with Reynaud in the month of May, one on May 16 and one on May 26. And the movie turns the meeting with Reynaud on May 16 into burlesque and into some kind of a scene of comedy. It reminded me of the scene in Henry V when Henry V is courting the woman with her awkward French, with his awkward French.
Right.
What did you make of that?
Well, the awkward French part is right, but everything else about it was wrong. Although, yeah, this is another place where you wish it had been a longer movie and they'd spent at least 5 minutes on that scene instead of 45 seconds or whatever it was, or maybe a minute and a half. I don't know. It doesn't go on very long. And it's completely backwards. It was a very tense and difficult meeting with Churchill's prodding them. He's not the scene's just all wrong. That's completely correct. I think let me go back for a second, though, to the moving into number 10. Because you make a very important point about Churchill's magnanimity towards Chamberlain. I think that that also connects with another inaccuracy in one of the war cabinet meeting depictions, where Churchill lashes out and says, "Well, he wouldn't be in this position if it hadn't been for my predecessor." And the camera pans over to Chamberlain. He never said anything like that to Chamberlain in a meeting. At least none of the cabinet minutes that have been published that I've read through, actually reread them recently, show anything like that. And
that's stupid.
Right. And in fact, but Chamberlain also did not conspire with Halifax the way it's depicted in the movie to remove. In fact, Chamberlain flip-flopped back and forth. He was on Churchill's side against negotiations, then seemed to weaken, then went back again. It really was Churchill against Halifax. And another thing left out of the movie is that Churchill was consistently being backed up in those arguments with Halifax by Attlee and Greenwood from the Labor Party, right, who were in the war cabinet. And they sit there silently in the film. So you connect those two together, but, you know, you can almost go in chronological order. You know, the next scene or very shortly thereafter, maybe it was a scene before, is the new secretary, Elizabeth Leigh, no real person, but of course they fictionalize what went on. And Churchill barks at her about how loud the typewriter is. Well, one of the details about Churchill is that he went to great trouble to get custom made typewriters that were virtually noiseless. And it's true that he could bark at his secretaries for getting words wrong. And, you know, some of that is accurate. But, you know, that was one of those little details that they missed or thought was not important to leave out, because that's something he took some great trouble about. And it was also the case that Churchill would bark at his secretaries, but quite often he would then apologize to them later. There is one part of the movie that is accurate but moved around in a way I didn't care for. You know, in those first few weeks, as you mentioned, this ferocious activity of Churchill's and the amazing strain is under, and he was very brusque with a lot of people. I think the movie maybe gets a little of that in a couple of ways. And Clementine sends him a note. In the movie, I think they have him have her talking to him, but she sends him a note that's, you know, in all the letter volumes and many of the biographies saying, you know, you're being really rough on people, and this isn't going to work if you're that rough on people. And I think he took it to heart. So, you know, there's the relationship of him backing him up in the movie is not completely wrong. I just don't think they handle it terribly well.
The scene in Paris with Reynaud on May 16th shows Churchill to be something like a fool.
Yeah, right.
In the warmongering type of spirit, consistent with the caricatures of him by his conservative critics and political enemies. And in fact, if you read the account, you know, a scrupulous account of that meeting, Churchill is agonizing about whether they can respond with additional reinforcements of aerial support for the French army, which was otherwise disintegrating, and buck up the French who were fighting along with the English. His responses are far more shrewd than the French. He's shocked to find out they don't even know what's going on.
And they don't seem to have any reserves organized. Right. Yeah. He says, where are the reserves? And he says, there aren't any. Yeah.
In the film, it's Churchill who doesn't know what's going on.
Right.
You know, they look at him incredulously, like, what are you talking about? And in truth, it was the French who didn't know what was going on with their own troops.
Right. And I think, you know, that scene could have been a lot better if you would use the discussion back and forth about whether Britain should send essentially the rest of its air force over. That's what the French wanted. They wanted Britain to send all the rest of the fighters they had over. And the war cabinet back in London, because Churchill cabled them, said, we can send some. You know, it wasn't no. But some of Churchill's own advisors and Churchill's own instincts were torn on this.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, he really wanted to do it out of a gesture for the love of the French and, you know, fighting to the end. On the other hand, he knew and said at the time and then back in London, it would leave us defenseless if we lose all these planes because the losses of the British planes in operation were heavy. Now, you could have laid out that argument between them. I think it didn't fit what McCartan wanted to do for reasons you mentioned earlier, but it would have just as easily shown Churchill uncertain, doubtful, torn by different impulses, which was true. And it would have served the narrative just the same way. That's a scene I can't I can give you a defense for the underground scene, and we'll come to that. But I can't give any kind of defense or explanation or justification for the way they did the meeting in Paris. And then they totally skipped the second one on, I think, you said, May 24, 23?
May 26th.
Right, 26, right.
And he returns first thing in the morning on May 27th and has this incredible day that I think ends at 2 a.m.,
yes, right.
After returning from Paris with you know, the multiple war cabinet meetings, and I think a meeting of with the Japanese ambassador squeezed in along the way somewhere.
Right. Yeah, he kept busy. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. A couple other things that ought to be probably mentioned. You mentioned that, you know, there was no plot with Halifax. I don't think I'm waiting to hear back from Richard Langworth on this. There's a device in the first speech that Churchill gives on May 13. Now, one part of this is accurate. When Churchill came into the house on May 13 to give the I have nothing to offer a blood, toils, tears, and sweat speech, he was applauded loudly by the Labor Party, and the Conservative Party pretty much sat on their hands. They were almost silent to him. And that shows in the film if you're paying close attention. But what they did in the film is somebody in the back row passes word around that we're all to keep our eyes on Neville.
Right.
And if he pulls out his handkerchief and puts it up to his head, that means we can cheer for Churchill. And if he doesn't, then it means we don't applaud and we sit on our hands because we really don't like Churchill. And I'm quite certain nothing like that ever took place. And that's a complete invention, I am sure. But, you know, they had to stick that in anyway because the real story wasn't dramatic enough. Because the rest of that they've got essentially right, I think. And that speech was not – it was a very short speech. Not terribly well received by his own side in the House. And, you know, the post I have up on Powerline about this, I quote some of the diary entries of the conservatives saying, Winston's not going to last 5 months. We're already talking about a new government. This is hopeless. there are more quotes like that saying his appointments are terrible. This is an awful idea. They try to dramatize that a little bit in the movie with a little pastiche of people saying things like this that I didn't think was terribly effective, but is not inaccurate. I'll sort of put it that way. This list can go on a long time. I'll just mention one other that bothered me a bit. It's not entirely wrong, but there's a scene with him and his secretary where he's dictating the message to Colonel Nicholson, who's in command of the small British rear guard in Calais, which needs to be held if the Dunkirk evacuation is going to be successful. And he tells them in the telegram, you know, hold at all costs, you'll not be rescued. I think is the way they're dramatizing the movie. I don't think the real message said those things, except I did say you've got a hold. It's essential. And Nicholson, you know, cabled back, we're ready to do our duty, you know, down to the last, no matter what. Nicholson, I believe, by the way, I don't think they were all killed, as it was implied in the movie. I think that Nicholson, as I recall, was taken prisoner by the Germans and died in camp. The little twist they give on in the scene is they have the secretary sort of shocked at what she's having to type, understandably so, I think. And then Churchill kind of barks at her about it. If you read this, I think the best account is in the Gilbert book. Churchill was feeling very low about all that, had trouble getting through dinner, said after dinner that he felt nauseous. And there's a note, and I think it was General Ismay, who was at that dinner, said, what did he put? I can't seem to find it here. General Ismay said in his diary, he doesn't mention how sad he looked as he uttered those words. I mean, Churchill was very depressed about having to give that kind of order. And, you know, the movie kind of makes it seem like he was callous and indifferent to the fate he'd ordered to those men. And I thought that was an injustice to the truth of the matter. Even though some of the, you know, then Joe Wright, the director, has that tracking shot where he shows the Colonel Nicholson getting the message and then looking up the bombers that come over. And, you know, that's very effective filmmaking. But as I say, not the whole story and not fair to Churchill.
Well, I'm just going back to the bit with Chamberlain as giving the high sign to the Tories in Parliament.
Right.
It is part of the storytelling in the film because they come back to that in the very last scene that you refer to before Churchill, right, while he's giving that great Dunkirk speech. Is it on June 6th? June 4th?
June 4th, I think.
June 5th. He's giving that speech All eyes on the Tory part are on Chamberlain, and then he pulls out his hanky, and Churchill has subdued Chamberlain by the power of Churchill's oratory, which is the one thing that McCartan credits Churchill with.
Yeah, well, there is some truth to that. You know, we should tell the full story of the final epic showdown in the cabinet, in War Cabinet, on May 28. But there is some truth to that. After Churchill gives that speech to the full cabinet, Chamberlain falls into line and say, yeah, we should have no more talk of this negotiating with the Germans at all. Maybe we should go straight into all that because that's the heart of the movie. And as I say, I think they get that more right than wrong, although they've taken a few liberties and too many compressions. By the way, I think you can compare this. That showdown is also dramatized in the HBO mini movie a few years ago called Into the Storm with Brendan Gleeson playing Churchill. They also dramatize that movie tries to cover the sweep of the whole war, and they do it very badly, I think. And they have flashbacks and they jump around a bunch. And I think Gleeson is very flat as Churchill. And if you compare the two treatments side by side, I think you'd have to say Darkest Hour is much better, flaws and all. What happens is, as we've already referred to, was Lord Halifax, the foreign secretary, well thought of person by the party, was the alternative to Churchill to be prime minister on May 10th, threatens to resign if Churchill continues to be stubborn about agreeing to negotiations. There are various versions of this. Lukács has one in 5 days in London. There are a few others and some difference of opinion on exactly how this should be understood. But ultimately, Churchill says, I think I need to talk to the whole cabinet about this. Now, the whole cabinet is about 40 people in all. I think he says there are 25 people in the meeting. And it includes some holdovers from Chamberlain's cabinet. It includes some new members that Churchill has appointed from also his own loyalists in the Conservative Party, but a lot of Labour Party people. because it's a government of national unity being formed, as the Brits like to do in times of crisis. And that's when he, as you started to give the speech, he says a thought. He gives a whole survey of the war and how things are going. And at that point on May 28, it's still not clear how many troops you might be able to get back from Dunkirk. That was still over the next 2-3 days. And he says, I've thought long and hard about whether it's part of my duty to have to talk with that man. I should pause here and say, in the movie, they show Churchill trying to dictate that remark to his secretary and then stopping and not knowing where to go with it. And that's where the underground scene comes on. But I'll come back to that in a moment. And that's when he says, this is futile. We won't get any decent terms. And then he ends. And of course, the Brendan Gleeson version is very flat. But the version in Darkest Hours, Churchill delivering it with great drama and force, although marred by the improvisations of the screenwriter. And that's where you have that final sentence that if this Long Island story of ours is to end at last, let it end only when each one of us lies choking in his own blood upon the floor. And Churchill never told that story very fully in his memoirs. He just made reference in his memoirs to gave a survey of the war. He says people came and patted me on the back. But the diary entries, especially the one from Hugh Dalton, who was from the Labor Party in the cabinet and therefore not a natural supporter of Churchill's, said people just jumped up and cheered and ran around and patted him on the back. And then the line in Dalton's diary I've always liked was, not much more was said. There was not a flicker of dissent. Now, one detail that Darkest Hour gets right is that Chamberlain and Halifax were not in that full cabinet meeting. The Into the Storm dramatization does have Halifax in that meeting and getting up and walking out. So even the Into the Storm movie plays around with the facts of the matter and inserts a detail that's not accurate to the history of it. So you see, this is a problem endemic to Churchill movies, I think. And a lot of people, I think Lukács is one of them, says that this statement of the whole cabinet was in a certain sense a coup. This was Churchill, in other words, slamming the door on what Halifax wanted to do in front of the whole cabinet to marshal political support. One imagines that a lot of people came out of that meeting, and I should say there have been rumors going around London that a breach had opened between Churchill and Halifax. You know, I think Halifax was talking to people, other people in the cabinet. Attlee was probably telling some of his friends and aides that, oh my God, the war cabinet is not in disarray, but there's this big breach, and who knows what's going to happen here. And here was Churchill finding his voice and stomping on this, and what I've called a couple of times my own in writing, his great Machiavellian deed. Because even Halifax was mute when the war cabinet meets again. And just to be sure, and there's a little end note in Darkest Hour about this, Churchill goes to Halifax a few weeks later and says, our relations with the Americans are going to be really important. I need you to go to Washington to be our ambassador. In other words, he gets him out of town. And he did that with a couple of the other appeasers, like Samuel Hoare, made the ambassador to Portugal or some non-entity country. I think he replaced Halifax very shortly with Anthony Eden as foreign secretary. There's some political maneuvering going on here. I think that is expressed a bit in the film. Could have been better, more direct. But again, this is a part of the story that, for decades we didn't know about this. Now we do.
We know it largely, as you say, thanks to the diary of Hugh Dalton. And I think he's got a memoir that tells the same story. I notice, I think it's Lukács or Gilbert who notes that Dalton had it slightly different form.
Two different versions, right. Yes. Yeah.
And then Gilbert or Lukács questions, there's a marginal notation that corrects it into the form that we have it now as it's given
right
before the additions in the movie. And it makes you wonder what was really said, that the Gilbert or Lukács, whoever it is, questions whether it's not Churchill who corrected Dalton on that point. But in any event, it's great that we have it. It's a magnificent speech, one of his great moments.
Yeah, I mean, in a certain way, it maybe is, you can argue it's one of the, you could go as far as saying it's the most important speech Churchill ever gave. I think it ranks maybe in the top five, and it's one we didn't know about for 40 years, which is really an amazing thing to contemplate, right?
In Lukács's book, I mean, he calls that that these days, the hinge of fate, and if there's one speech that it turns on, it's that May 28th speech to the outer cabinet.
Right, right, yeah. All right, so now let me talk about the underground scene a little bit that's upset Kyle Smith, and you don't like it, but would you say it was stupid or?
Yeah.
You had a good adverb that went with that, I think. I don't know. Okay, so yeah, I mean, at first I'm watching this going, oh, come on, this nothing like this ever took place. And then I got to thinking, well, nothing like that ever took place except, you know, and this is what I wrote about on Powerline a couple of days ago is, you know, when you get to the Blitz a few months later, and by the way, I mean, even though these 3 weeks that the movie points to are, you know, the crucial 3 weeks in a lot of ways, England wasn't out of the woods for quite a long time. You know, well into the fall, you thought there might be a German invasion at any time and so forth. And so, you know, after the Blitz, Churchill would often visit places that had been bombed and damaged, and he would be cheered by the crowds, and people would say, you know, give it back to him just as hard. And that's when the, you know, the slogan came, London can take it. You know, Churchill wrote about and talked about how he drew strength and inspiration from the courage of the people. So I think in a certain way, that's the underlying theme behind the underground visit. It's all out of order because you couldn't carry the movie forward to the Blitz. And I think it is a mistake to say that Churchill drew his inspiration from the people and not from himself. I think that's correct. But there's one little detail of that underground scene that kind of rescued it for me. And that's when you have the recitation of Horatius at the bridge. And now that may seem like cliche, and in a certain way it is, except it's one of those little details of Churchill. You know, he'd memorized all 700 lines of Macaulay, and you know, that scene was one that he knew well, that it sort of parallels his character. And so I don't think it's a grievous sin to sort of put Churchill on the same wavelength with his own people in some reciprocal way. I didn't care for the way that they inserted the names of those people in the middle of his choking in her own blood speech. I thought that was wholly unnecessary and detracted from it. But it does kind of, I see the story arc that the guy was getting at. And although it's not historically accurate and, you know, I think it's susceptible of mistaken interpretations or understandings by viewers, I actually think it actually works okay. Totally fair to think I'm totally nuts on that, by the way.
So. I stand with the original Hayward on that one, Steve, but not the belated realization of the greatness of that scene. I think if you read Lukacs, there would be ground for saying that the movie reverses the causation, that it was Churchill who he couldn't have called forth something from the British people that they lacked. He didn't do that. But without him, it wouldn't have been called forth. And that's what I hate about that scene.
Yeah.
They could have gone down without a fight and would have gone down without a fight if Halifax were at the controls.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then going back to the underground scene, Churchill begins his recitation of the stanza from the Lays of Ancient Rome, and it's completed by a black West Indian immigrant, the one – black guy in the thing. And I thought, really?
Yeah. Well, you know, yes, that was my first thought too. But my second thought, Scott, was that will infuriate the left. And in fact, I think it already has. Because in other words, you know, well, another way of thinking about that, and maybe I'm too cheerful because I live out here in Lotus Land on the left coast, is these kind of virtues aren't limited to just your stereotypical white British people, but in fact, it belongs to anybody of any race. And, you know, that's the message the left doesn't like. I don't think that's the intent of the screenwriter. I think he probably put it in there for reasons more along the lines that you're thinking. But I think these things cut two ways. So, you know, that didn't bother me. and if it annoys some people on the left who are so easily annoyed, then I'm for it.
It seemed to me a bow to political correctness that was kind of tough to take.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a thing that, as I say, can cut both ways. Why don't we get out here? We're going on a bit long, and let's do a couple of things. A couple of things are pretty good. I mean, I think the dramatization of the phone call with President Roosevelt is just wonderful, showing – I mean, I think that's not quite accurate, but it really made Roosevelt look kind of contemptible, and that's always an enjoyable thing to do, right? They missed the opportunity of one of the things that happened during those weeks is – Churchill shaving in the, this would have been a great scene. Churchill shaving in the background and suddenly saying to Randolph, who's nearby, "I know how we're going to win this war. I'll drag the Americans into it." You know, that would have been a neat element to have included, right? Except you couldn't finish that story because that doesn't happen for another year and a half, right? I think there's a great unmade film about Churchill. You know, I wrote this long, fairly long piece for the Weekly Standard on Churchill movies, and we either concentrate on you know, his early life. I think the Young Winston movie I rewatched and think is really pretty good. And then The Wilderness Years is terrific. Though I have to say it's got a couple of invented and inaccurate scenes in it that are done for narrative purposes. One that's even a little bit like the underground scene in Darkest Hour. But it's still the best, I think, of all the Churchill renditions by Robert Hardy. I think The Gathering Storm with Albert Finney is really quite good. It's, you know, shorter than The Wilderness Years, of course. It's just a couple hours. But then people always try and focus on those early years of the war, early period, or the war itself. There's no good movie about Churchill at the end of the war. I could think you'd do a great drama about the whole arc of time from, say, the Yalta Conference through the election of June of 45. Be tricky to do, but I think that'd be a good one to do. There is John Lithgow playing Churchill in The Crown on Netflix, and I don't really care for that performance at all, or the script. But then I guess maybe we ought to, we mentioned a few books, but maybe we ought to go through and this and then end with this is, you know, what books people should read. We both mentioned the John Lukacs book, 5 Days in London, May 1940, right?
I think it's kind of an essential book, but extremely eccentric. And
oh, yeah. Well, he's an eccentric guy. I know him a little bit. I met him at a Churchill conference 15 years ago. He's really fun. You know, he's a Hungarian emigre. He came here at the end of the war as a young man. And taught at Philadelphia at Temple University. I forget. No, that's not it. Some other little place. Anyway, there's a second book of his.
Yeah.
Actually, there's two or three of his, right? The other one that you probably know is The Duel,
right?
The 100-day war, 100-day struggle between Churchill and Hitler. And it covers the same period in about 8 or 9 pages. As I later said, I got to thinking that maybe it could be a whole separate book on just these 5 days in May where this all culminates. You know, the choking on our own blood speech. And, you know, he joked that someday I'll write 3 hours one afternoon, which, you know, because his first book on the war, on World War II, was called The Last European War from the late 70s, I think. And that just covers a time period of 1939 to 1941 when we entered the war, because his argument there is conveyed in the title, is that this was a European war and then it became a world war after Pearl Harbor. That's very similar to the thesis of Victor Davis Hanson in his new book on the Second World Wars, plural. He said this was a bunch of border wars that all got bound up together in one world war eventually, right? So there's Gilbert you mentioned, volume 6 called Finest Hour of the Official Biography. And there's also a new book out. And where have I put it? It ought to be here on my desk, and I think I put it somewhere else. New book out just this year by David Owen, who had been in the Labor government under James Callaghan in the 70s. And it covers this period also, but it reproduces in the book the full cabinet minutes of all these war cabinet meetings so that you can read through them for yourself. I forget the title of it, but if you look up David Owen, and I think he may have called Cabinet's Finest Hour or something like that, because his argument is this is cabinet government at its best. Which is another thing you could talk about at some length, is dramatizing the way the British cabinet works. Is that's not easy to do for any audience, but especially an American audience. So what else? Am I leaving anything else out?
Well, I would just mention Max Hastings' book, Winston's War. The first chapter of it covers this territory and a few pages into the second chapter. And he does it, I think, brilliantly, concisely.
Yeah.
And I agree with his judgments. I'm not sure about the rest of the book, but I certainly appreciated his review of this period.
Yeah, he's very good. I get to meet everybody. I met him once too at dinner 10 years ago or so. And yeah, I should read more of his work than I do.
One Powerline post that you should do is something like top 10 Churchill books for people looking for Christmas gifts, like I do the 5 His Chambers books or whatever.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's a good idea. We could do that. All right. And you know, we could write
these
speeches.
There are so many. And, you know, even the history section, the World War II history section of a good Barnes & Noble will have so many books on this period. The average reader, I think, is kind of lost. You really need to to cover a lot of territory before you know you've got it down.
Yeah, that's right. So I will just add one last note on this and then a couple of news items and then we'll quit. So in my post this week, I had quoted, and I've gotten a lot of feedback on this, I quoted a few letters from my great aunt to my grandfather. And I think I said I thought there were some gaps in the letters because I didn't find anything between 42 and 44. Well, lo and behold, I discovered that the family archivist, that would be me, hadn't looked hard enough. And I found a whole another large accordion folder yesterday with dozens and dozens more letters. And I've only looked at a couple of them, and they're pretty – so I may do a series on that because people seem to like all that. And I'll say as we're taping, I mean, this will get posted later and people will be listening, you know, not 10 minutes from now. But as we're taping, two great things have happened. President Trump has signed the tax cut bill. And according to one news report I've seen, Al Franken says he will resign on January 2nd.
You cynic.
Right. Well, we'll see about that. I have this hunch, by the way, that the only reason for delaying after the first of the year is I'll bet he gets some small escalation in his Senate pension.
You may be right, but I think he stuck around for his staff.
That could be. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's lots of reasons you might do it that way, but right. Okay. Well, thanks, Scott. I mean, we could go on forever about this, but we've gone on long enough, and that was fun. And I think all of our listeners should go see the movie and see for themselves what they make of it. And with that, everybody, we will say goodbye until next time.
Thanks, Steve.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com.